You are listening to Smile Politely Radio on WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Yes, once again, and as we often do pretty much every Friday, it is Smile Politely Radio. That gentleman, of course, is correct. Smile Politely Radio on the air right now on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, and available if you miss any or all of the show as a handy-dandy portable podcast and audio companion at the website smilepolitely.com or subscribe via iTunes. Speaking of smilepolitely.com, Champaign-Urbana's premier online magazine and home of Smile Politely Radio, and the place where you should be telling your story about Champaign, Urbana, and surrounding communities. What's going on in your neck of the woods? Head to smilepolitely.com, write for the site, maybe even join us right here on the big radio show, as always, or as occasionally, depending on the week and the schedules. I'm joined by John, the one and only Steinbacher.
Well, usually it's, depending on the schedules, I am joined by Jason Brown.
Yeah, well, I'm on this microphone this time, though.
All right, so. Fair enough. We should point out that there's currently a campaign on Smile Politely where you can generously possibly give some money to help with a site redesign and a print edition. And one cool thing about the site redesign that I've heard rumors of is that, you know, there'll be a little bit more real estate for the important things like us.
Yes, perhaps one of the most important components of the site will be even more Smile Politely Radio.
Or maybe not. I don't know. I haven't seen it yet.
No, I don't know either.
Just trying to make us happy.
I'm nudging them in that direction, okay. Slowly. So, smilepolitely.com is the place to go to check out all sorts of stuff, including our ongoing series of articles and segments here on the radio show, Science Politely. We will have another community comment, Science Politely segment coming up later on in the program.
And there's a an event on Sunday to bring the kids to through that they talked about on the show. I believe it's at the Orpheum.
Yes.
A exciting science kids event. So if you're listening not to the podcast, you should go. If you're listening to the podcast, then as we always say, we hope you had a great time.
Yes. I know that you were all there and enjoyed it thoroughly. So this week, we are very concerned with something that everybody should be very, very concerned with, and that is water. Lots and lots of water. Water everywhere, and hopefully lots of it good enough to drink. We have a couple representatives on the show this week from the Prairie Rivers Network, based right here in our fantastic Shambana community. I have Robert and Tracy joining me on the show. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. And first, because I don't want to bore anybody with reading my own research, why don't you guys tell us a little bit about Prairie Rivers Network, what it is, and what it does?
Well, very quickly, we are a nonprofit conservation environmental organization, and we work on clean water and healthy river issues all over the state of Illinois.
All over the state. Okay, excellent. And it specifically, let's talk about right now, what are some of the current, there are always, myriad issues with protecting the water in the state of Illinois, but what are some of the big things right now that are making news and that you guys are really focused on getting the word out about?
One of the issues we're working on currently is a proposed coal mine in Vermilion County.
Okay.
That is, it is a water issue because it proposes to take coal out of the ground, crush it, and wash it with water, lots and lots of water, that may either be pulled out of the Salt Fork, the Vermilion River, mm-hmm. or out of our groundwater supply. And we're talking about 500,000 to 1 million gallons of water a day to wash coal that otherwise could be used either for fish and wildlife, recreation on the river, or as a drinking water supply.
Right. That sounds like entirely too much coal just for stockings. So that's all right, bad joke out of the way. coal mining hasn't been big in this area. I don't think it has been for a while. Is that right?
Well, historically it has. There were some mines over, underground mines over in Vermilion County, but
okay.
Many of them have closed, some due to roof cave-ins,
okay.
Because they weren't stable and not safe for the coal miners. But there is a resurgence of coal in Illinois.
Okay.
For a number of different reasons. Part of it, pressure on Appalachia, trying to stop mountaintop removal. Also, now our coal is much dirtier than other coal basins.
Okay.
But because there's been some advances in air pollution control, now our dirty coal is able to be burned again here in the U.S., and it's also, there's a lot of pressure on it right now for it to be exported over to China. So unfortunately, we're seeing a lot more coal being proposed to come out of the ground. So that's not only bad for water, but it's also bad for farmland.
Mm.
It's taking farmland out of production. It's really not good for any of the sites that are hosting it because it leaves a mess behind.
Right.
And it's really not the direction, you know, our state or our country should be going. We really should be moving away from coal. We have other ways of getting our energy right now.
Sure.
And some of those, the people that have kind of stood up to the coal mine or are asking questions about it are farmers, correct, or in the Vermilion County area?
Right. I mean, this farmland in Vermilion County is really prime farmland. This is, you know, mm-hmm. we live in the heartland. This mm-hmm. is excellent soil. It's not really... even though our state, you know, does boast coal as well, to get that coal out of the ground, you have to take farmland out of production.
Right.
And, you know, for some of these seventh generation farmers, this is their lifestyle. This is what the communities are built on. And it would be quite a change of life, quality of life, really.
Mm-hmm. Aside from what sounds like, well, what is an excessive amount of water being used just to clean the coal, what are some of the other potential threats to the water supply, the aquifer, the entire watershed as a result of increased mining activities?
So it not only takes water to wash the coal, but it's also for a lot of operations on site. And most of that coal either leave with the coal, or it'll be left behind as slurry. So after you wash the coal, there's fine particles of coal that are left behind in kind of a paste or a slurry. Those are held in huge impoundments, these big pits above ground. And we're talking about probably 400 acres of farmland being turned into essentially toxic pits that mm-hmm. hold this coal slurry. And as it rains, those will fill up with water. And that water can't just sit there. It'll slowly be discharged to area streams. So that's really the other part. You know, it's not just a water supply issue where you're taking a lot of water to wash the coal, but then you're making that water dirty and you're releasing some of that back into area streams. And you know, one of the things that we're really concerned about with the Salt Fork is that it boasts federally endangered and threatened mussels. It's a really special stream. Mm-hmm. Things live there that can't live elsewhere, and you know, that's dirty coal water going into a stream that's really pristine and used by a lot of people for paddling is not what the direction we should be going into.
And a part of the Salt Fork was also recently they transplanted. You mentioned
right,
mussels.
Right.
They transplanted some all the way from, I think, Pennsylvania.
That's right.
Because it was a habitat that was there, endangered there, and the habitat here at the Salt Fork was similar enough that they've actually taken hold in the Salt Fork River. So, serving a number of purposes, not just us having water, but, you know, probably hundreds of other reasons why it's pretty important to protect it. Besides the proposed coal mine, what are some other issues, either locally or statewide, that are on your radar in terms of stepping in and trying to keep the water safe?
Sure.
The rivers, specifically, obviously.
Well, yeah, we work on a whole host of issues, pretty much anything that touches on water. So a lot of it is pollution, preventing pollution, and really making sure that we have clean water resources.
Mm-hmm.
So that touches several people's work within our organization. Watching and enforcing Clean Water Act permits, looking at ag pollution, the coal pollution that Tracy talked about.
Mm.
And then we also do some habitat work, and I do a lot of invasive species work.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my time is focused on the Asian carp threat, which over the last couple of years has had a lot of it's gotten a lot of media play.
A lot of press.
Yeah, especially in the Chicago and the Great Lakes region.
Right.
Because, very briefly, Asian carp are an invasive species that were brought over, imported into this country, into catfish ponds. They escaped and got into the Mississippi River system in the 70s. And over the last few decades, they've worked their way northward. And right now are just outside the Great Lakes. They're being held back by an electric barrier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it's basically a few diodes within the canal system just outside of Chicago that hopefully are preventing Asian carp from getting into the Great Lakes and wrecking what is a $7 billion fishery. So, I mean, that's a lot of money at stake. There's a lot of people in the Great Lakes states that are very concerned, and they've been putting a lot of pressure on Chicago to fix the problem. And we are, what I do is essentially to advocate for a better, more permanent solution, which would be to restore what was essentially, what was at up until the late 1800s, a natural divide between the Mississippi waters and the Great Lakes. So until that time, those watersheds were separate. People made the decision to connect them, which had some, it had a series of impacts, but one thing it did was open the door for invasive species to move.
Right.
And so now there's a movement afoot to restore that natural separation and prevent the carp from getting in the lakes.
Is that part of I know the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been getting pressure from a lot of organizations lately in terms of ramping up the speed, certainly, and the planning in terms of preventing Asian carp from getting to the Great Lakes. Are you guys involved in any of that, or is that those lines?
We are. I mean, we were in constant contact with the Army Corps, and as you might suspect, it's a very complicated issue because it touches on a whole host of states, on many waterways, and so there are many federal agencies and state agencies involved in looking at this issue. The Corps has kind of a lead role, and they've been tasked by Congress to study this problem, and they wanted to run this study out over the course of a couple of years. Congress then came back and said over the summer that they needed to speed it up. The Corps kind of said, no, we're not going to do that. But they will have kind of an interim report ready in a quicker time frame. And so, I mean, we work with the Corps, certainly, but they're a responsive, in my mind, they're muscle. Mm-hmm. And we need Congress, who's the brains, to tell the muscle what to do. And so so either a solution's probably got to come from Congress or possibly from within the city of Chicago, because there are a whole host of benefits that that could accrue to the Chicago region should separation go forward.
Sure.
And part of what I do is kind of, spreading the word about what those benefits are for Illinois and for Chicago.
Sure. The I knew about that, I think, because it was a real small news item when the election was going on. And if you're not glued to like Great Lakes news, you probably wouldn't have heard about it. But that was one thing that there were a number of legislators and people who were sort of criticizing either Congress or the Army Corps of Engineers for not moving fast enough because of various reasons and various signs of Asian carp and things like that.
Right. It's good to make political hay out of, especially in a bunch of swing states like around the Great Lakes. Which, and Obama and Mitt Romney both mentioned carp specifically because people in those, they both needed Michigan, they both needed Ohio, and people in those states, it's like if you poll carp numbers, 95% of the people in those states are very serious about stopping carp, and you can't get 95% of people agree on what day of the week it is. So
sure, right.
it's a winning message.
In addition to the Asian carp, there are a lot of other things that are either have been ignored for a long time or just now sort of understanding the impact on water. And one of them is, sort of the interconnectedness of all of the various waterways, watersheds, you name it. And two things that I'll ask you guys about if you're involved in are advocating for natural lawn care and then proper disposal of pharmaceuticals and things like that, which have, again, not, I think it's a more recent topic and people don't know quite as much about it, but you guys probably certainly do. So.
Yeah, actually, a little known fact about what actually pollutes our waterways. Nutrients are the number one pollution for Illinois waters, and that comes from over application of fertilizers on ag land. It comes from sewage treatment plants. It comes from too much use of phosphorus-based fertilizers on our lawn and manicured yards corporate campuses.
How else would we make it green?
That's right. Well, part of it's cultural change and us getting used to more native plantings and not have everything so green. And part of it's just informing ourselves by soil tests on just how much is needed. So a few years back, we were involved with a push at the state level to pass a bill to ban phosphorus-based fertilizers on state land, and that did pass. And that's in effect right now. So it's a small piece. I mean, there isn't a whole lot of land that's owned by the sure. state, managed by the state, but it was symbolic, showing that, you know, if the state can do it, we can too, and that also pushes for wider availability of those products.
It's
so
a-
that. So that, you know, people, some stores start stocking some of these low phosphorus or no phosphorus fertilizers. And then, you know, I think considering what we've gone through last year and probably will go through in future years, drought is a big piece of this too.
Right.
And it's part of us adjusting just what our expectations are for our outside world. And instead of maintaining this kind of outdoor turf or carpet, mm-hmm. It's adjusting what we expect in terms of how we use our water and how we use our chemicals and how we use our fertilizer. So that's one piece. And then we also have had a program looking at pharmaceuticals also. And really, it's mainly an education campaign to let people know that proper disposal of pharmaceuticals is important,
mm-hmm.
that all ends up in our waterway at some point. And, you know, especially for communities that are drinking the same water where the wastewater is being disposed of,
right.
Particularly in communities along the Fox River, that's critical, because
yeah.
it's really hard to treat for those things once they're in the waterway. The pathway is to prevent it from getting there in the first place.
Right, because the conventional wisdom was, you know, if you had expired prescriptions or something, well,
right.
just flush them.
It down.
Yeah.
When really, there are take-back programs now in mm-hmm. Local hospitals. In fact, Carl has been involved in the past in some of those take-back programs. There's household hazardous waste pickup programs,
mm-hmm.
and then there's also, even though it's not ideal, and it depends on what type of landfill you have, but if you can wrap those in containers and put them in the garbage, which in the end is safer than dumping them and flushing them down
okay.
the drain.
Let's go back to the fertilizers and sort of agricultural and landscape runoff. What you mentioned, the phosphorus is the issue. For at least is one of the big issues in terms of the excessive nutrients that makes its way into the waterways. What is it about the soil around here versus other areas that doesn't necessitate any additional phosphorus? Is it just because we're in the Midwest, that's why the farmland is so great, like it doesn't need anything extra?
Ooh, that's a hard one, and I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer it. I know that we do have some baseline levels of phosphorus in our soil,
mm-hmm.
But we, because of the type of very intensive row crop agriculture that we have here, I think what the demands we put on our land require additional nutrients to be added.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's about yield.
It's about, right, and I think part of it is making sure it's being applied at the right time of the year, at the right rate.
Okay.
Which are, you know, there are very specific directions now on exactly how much should be applied on the land and at what time of year. But it's also really important that we have some buffer between farmland and our waterways,
mm-hmm.
so that you have forested edges of our streams,
mm-hmm.
and tall grasses, filter strips, things that can help create a buffer and help filter some of those additional nutrients out before they reach the waterway. So
mm-hmm.
that if you do apply and there does, you know, a large rainstorm comes, that there's some of that's being taken up instead of just running off the land into our streams. So some of those more naturalized, called best management practices,
mm-hmm.
really can make quite a difference.
Okay. I've been seeing a lot about, and you mentioned natural filtering, which is why it takes us to our next topic, which is I'm seeing a lot of stuff about rain gardens nowadays and water management being part of controlling runoff and what makes it into the lake or the river that actually ends up making it into you as drinking water. What kinds of natural programs are there, or natural installations are there, that do a better job filtering the water than even the water treatment plants sometimes do?
Probably a better sense of this.
There's a lot of different things that can be done. Really, I mean, the general thing you want to keep in mind is that you want to slow the water down from,
mm-hmm.
you know, from where it's falling to the drain pipe that's leading to the nearest stream. And unfortunately, a lot of our communities have been designed to very quickly take that water
right.
and rush it to those storm drains and rush it to the streams.
Because we have to keep the roads clear.
Right? That's right.
So, yeah.
And I think my sense is that there's just not a widespread understanding of how polluted rain is
mm-hmm.
after it's become runoff. You know, I mean, people just think, well, it's clean, it's rain, but once it picks up everything that's in the on the streets and in yards, I mean, it very quickly becomes polluted. And
Yeah, so things like directing your gutters towards what are rain gardens, essentially patches of area that are planted with native plantings, and you've put a layer of sand and rock in there that help kind of hold the water and allow it to be taken up by the roots of the plants. Mm-hmm. That is a little filtration system, kind of holding system that anyone can build in their yard. That can make a difference. Communities can get behind putting in vegetated parking lots, strips in parking lots, mm-hmm. that help take some of this up. You can have permeable pavements, which allows for some of that water, instead of just sheeting off of the concrete or the asphalt, it allows for it to actually kind of sink in. That's more advanced and takes some advanced planning.
Sure.
You know, strips within avenues in towns, that can make a difference.
And not only on the clean water side, but I mean, it can help ease the pressure on just the flood management as well. And that's something that we've looked at in Chicago, even connected to the CARP issue. Is one of the problems with going in and reworking the Chicago waterway system is that it's heavily managed to
sure.
quickly move water out of the Chicago area, which was traditionally a swamp. Mm-hmm. And so if you go in and you start reworking it, well, you know, people worry that their basements are going to flood. There'll be increased flooding. And certainly if you just threw fill in the river somewhere, that could be a problem if you heedlessly
right.
did that. But, you know, if you start looking at green infrastructure on a citywide basis, rain gardens, green rooftops, that really could play a role both in cleaning up the water and in managing the level of flooding and how much water has to be redirected either downstream or out to Lake Michigan.
Yeah, and that's something that I know that former Mayor Daley was very big on in the city, was greening Chicago, and big portions of that. I know people have probably seen photos online, the green roof right on City Hall. But there's obviously, in terms of water management, you're right that the pipes have been under the city for, I don't even know how, probably 100 years, some of them, and are not adequate for the needs of the city anymore.
That's right. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head right there, and that's a large part of what I'm doing is
okay.
making that point that what the status quo is not working.
Right. What kind of, in terms of water management, like we talked about with green infrastructure, what kind of an impact can that have, taking the load off the existing infrastructure and helping to prolong it or keep it from failing, and, you know, and having massive, you know, downtown basement floods?
mm-hmm. Well, I think that the population is so large.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sprawling megalopolis, Chicago. I mean, as long as we're talking about Chicago. And it has historically had major hydrology problems. However, I do think that the green infrastructure piece certainly is good for that first flush, mm-hmm. that first, you know, fairly toxic, where it's getting all the oil and
mm-hmm.
all the pollutants right off the city streets, off of people's lawns. It's really good for catching that and preventing that first initial kind of, you know, toxic loading into either the river or the lake, wherever it ends up going.
Sure.
So all of that would be a huge positive. You know, there are other major infrastructure projects going on in Chicago, which, you know, we don't have time maybe to get into, but, you know, they're building large reservoirs in Chicago
mm-hmm.
to store massive amounts of water to prevent flooding. And working those things in combination, I think, could be would be one strategy. But certainly Chicago really needs to work on its gray infrastructure as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the few, you know, for a city of its size, it's working on very old infrastructure, including combined sewers, which basically means that all wastewater goes directly to the stream in cases of flooding. So
mm-hmm.
when the wastewater treatment plants can't handle the load because of a high rain event, they just dump it straight, basically.
Yeah.
It's basically dumped straight into the river. And until it's gray, until the pipe system, until they really rework the infrastructure, both green and gray, that will continue to be a problem.
Okay. If with just a little bit of time that we've got left, if people want to learn more about Prairie Rivers Network and more importantly, some of the water issues that the state is facing, where could they go and where should they look?
Our website is www.prairierivers.org.
Okay.
If any of you are listening right now, we're having a happy hour tonight at Quality Bar from 6 to 8.
All
please
right.
come out, meet some of the staff and board members.
Right after the show. That's great timing.
That's right. yeah, what else? I mean, that we are always present at public meetings having throughout the state having to do with clean water and water supply. If you have any questions, please feel free to visit us on Facebook, on our website.
Yeah, Facebook, Twitter, website. Certainly, you can always just stop by the office, too. I mean, it's very open, and we're always happy to have people call us or stop by with their questions or issues.
Excellent. All right.
And we're a member organization, and I mean, it's very important to us that to have that membership in place, because they are the one, you know, our members are the ones that bring us a lot of the issues that we need to work on and alert us to problems. And it's very important on a legal basis for us to have standing in courts to solve some of these issues. So,
well, and it's also important. I mean, we're located in East Central Illinois, and while we work with partners throughout the state, often our members are the eyes and the ears to tell us what's going on in the areas where, you know, we aren't always present.
Sure, sure. All right. Robert and Tracy from Prairie Rivers Network, thank you both very much for coming to the studio this week.
Thank you.
Appreciate you guys for being on the show. And again, check them out online. Search Prairie Rivers Network on Facebook, Twitter. Follow them to see what's going on. Get the latest on what's pertinent and important to Illinois water. That is going to wrap up most of the show for this week here on Smile Politely Radio, but we do have a Science Politely segment coming up for this week. This week's Science Politely segment is from Laura Stein, a PhD candidate in animal biology at the University of Illinois, coincidentally right here in Champaign.
When we think of parents, we tend to think of humans or other mammals, or maybe birds feeding their young at the nest. Primarily in animals, but also to an extent in humans, there is much emphasis on the importance of genes, the blueprint that builds your physical appearance and even aspects of your personality. However, more and more we are finding that your parents' behavior has important consequences for what makes you, well, you. Absolutely love bananas? This might be the result of your mother craving bananas while she was pregnant. Are you easily stressed out, or do you handle difficult situations without your blood pressure rising? You guessed it, how you respond to stress is linked to how much stress your mom experienced while she was pregnant. As children of parents or other adults who raised us, and as some of us parents ourselves, we are intrigued by the way in which parents influence their offspring. In humans, however, we cannot easily test these ideas. After all, we can't control for many different factors, such as human society and culture. But parenting is found throughout the animal kingdom, and sometimes where you least expect it. Insect parents work together to farm food for their babies. Some lizards mate for life, and in most species of fish, it is the father that provides all the parental care. It's easy to imagine how a mother might change her baby's physical appearance and behavior. She has a direct link to the growing fetus or developing egg. Because of this, there is lots of focus on the importance of moms in both humans and animals. But what about the dads? Do dads influence their kids in the same way as moms do? I study the three-spined stickleback, a small fish only an inch and a half long, to answer some of these questions. The dads do all the work here. They develop bright blue eyes and a deep red throat to attract females. After building a nest, they dance in zigzags to show off their hard work. Some males are more showy than others, dancing out in the open. Others have a shyer personality, and will only zigzag a few times near their nest. If a female is impressed, she will come over, lay eggs, and leave. The male is now responsible for caring for the eggs and guarding the nest from predators. One of my major questions is whether males with different personalities respond to threats to their offspring in different ways. Yes, these little fish have big personalities. As it turns out, there is evidence of personality in almost every animal imaginable. From spiders, to frogs, to birds, and even, yes, to fish. What do we mean by personality? Well, as anybody who has ever had a dog or cat could tell you, individual animals differ from one another. Perhaps you had a cat that was very shy, or a dog that was always friendly to everyone. These consistent individual differences are personality. Imagine now a fish that was aggressive in every situation. This is really helpful when defending a territory, but probably isn't the best idea when trying to court a female, and is downright dangerous when encountering a predator. I have long been interested in the study of animal personality because it can lead to these dangerous behaviors where we would expect animals to try and behave optimally. Here at the University of Illinois, I found three spine stickleback dads in the lab consistently differed in how they parent. Some were duds, some were attentive to their babies no matter what, even when a rubber predator was in the vicinity. This didn't have anything to do with how big they were or how many eggs they had. It appears that differences in parenting are intrinsic to the individuals. How good of a parent you are also matters to your offspring. When we showed the babies the same fake predator, the amount of anti-predator behavior they performed depended not only on who their dad was, but also how their father responded to the predator while he was parenting. That is, how a dad responds to a threat can help his offspring survive in a world with that threat, even though his offspring were merely embryos at the time and had never experienced it before themselves. Dads do matter.
That wraps up this week's Science Politely segment, and a big thanks to everyone who has been providing those. Check out smilepolitely.com for more Science Politely articles and segments right here on the show as well as a part of the podcast. That's going to wrap up Smile Politely Radio for this week. As always, if you missed any or all of this week's show or want to catch up on any previous shows, check out the podcast. It'll be available. This show will be available early next week on the site, and you can always subscribe also via iTunes. Hip Hop Express is coming to the studio in just a bit, but as always, we're going to wrap it up with Connie's Hot Flashes on the Movies on 90.1 FM WEFT Champaign.